At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. In this episode, we're going to talk about a condition that affects over 100 million people worldwide and is the second leading cause of death in older adults. Alzheimer's disease is what we're going to be talking about, and this is a condition of the brain that usually starts with selective memory loss and gets worse over time, resulting in lots of other symptoms ranging from impaired judgment to issues with movement. Join us today for a deep dive into what Alzheimer's disease is, what causes it, and what can be done about it. All that and more on this episode of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. I'm happy also to announce that the second most handsome doctor in North America back on the podcast, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Let's see, other updates. I'm in the middle of a three-week stretch in the hospital. Finished some training a little while ago. Training is going fine, as I suspect yours is as well.
The only remarkable thing about my training is that I happened to hit YOLO PR on the deadlift, the 340 kilos.
Where was the news? Where was the announcement?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I had tried
you
to
hold a press nobody release. Nobody cares.
Nobody cared, and nobody showed up to the press release. But it was one of those things. I actually thought about it afterwards. I had not tested a 1RM in training, a one repetition maximum in training in. I mean, I couldn't even remember. So I'm just ballparking it like 10 years because every time I would just be at a meet, you know. But I didn't have any meets scheduled. Still don't have any meets scheduled, and my deadlift for whatever reason was feeling good.
Spicy. Yeah.
Yeah. So 15 pound PR, which is, I was pumped on that. Also happy to be now a few pounds heavier than yours. So that makes me feel good about myself. In worse news, I did try to load 350 afterwards, which is 771, and did not budge.
Yeah.
Like just zero. But, you know, the body doesn't know the difference between you completing a rep and you just, you know, tugging against something, right? So maybe I just counts.
Yeah.
I was pretty pumped on that, but we'll see. I have some maybe. We'll call them delusions of grandeur, maybe for like a master's next year. I could maybe do something there.
That's legit, man. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I don't see any deadlift PRs in my near future. I'm not really training towards that end. I'm doing a lot of other stuff and feeling pretty good. So I'll just keep rolling with that.
Yeah. At some point, look, again, this is a weird time in the universe where both of our training happens to be going like fine. So something's going to happen.
Storm clouds are gathering.
Yeah, it's just like this is foreshadowing. Something's happening. But enough about us. We're going to talk about Alzheimer's. So let's start this out with Austin. How much Alzheimer's disease do you see in the hospital? And we're going to get into definitions and everything, so we don't need to like, you know, fully go down that rabbit hole. But I guess I'm wondering, patients that come in for some sort of medical condition, how many times do you see Alzheimer's on their chart? Like this is just something they already have.
I see dementia very frequently. Like most days I will see dementia or cognitive impairment in some fashion. The issue is that the confidence with which we can label somebody or provide that diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is fuzzy, as I'm sure we'll get into, particularly while a person is alive. And so I am generally more reluctant to, you know, diagnostically label somebody as having Alzheimer's disease, particularly when I'm seeing them in the hospitalized setting, when they're sick and have a lot of other stuff going on. But I see dementia, you know, broadly speaking, all the time. And dementia can come from a bunch of different causes, and people's cognition itself can be impacted by a bunch of different causes, even if they don't actually have dementia. So it gets quite fuzzy. But yeah, I see dementia a lot.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a good place to kick this off. So what is dementia? So the definition of dementia is it's an acquired disorder in which there's a decline in one or more cognitive domains. So this could be something like learning and memory, language, executive function, and so on. It's actually been sort of like an evolution of this definition. Before it was like two or more, you know, areas of cognitive decline. And then I don't know if like the DSM and, you know, the NIA, if they like went to war and they were like, hey, look, no, we're using one of ours. But now it's been sort of liberalized to have one or more cognitive domains where there's a decline. And the deficit must represent a decline from a previous level of function and be severe enough to interfere with daily function and independence. The most common form of dementia, which is what we're going to talk about on this podcast, is Alzheimer's disease in older adults. And this accounts for about 60 to 80% of cases of dementia. Alzheimer's primarily affects older adults, and while the exact cause of Alzheimer's is unknown, under the microscope, it's characterized by the development of amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the brain, which are associated with the gradual loss of connections between nerve cells, these are called neuronal synapses, and the loss of neurons themselves in specific areas of the brain, like the hippocampus and the neocortex, the latter making up about 90% of the two hemispheres of the brain that you may know as the cerebral cortex. So that's a lot of word salad and fancy sounding words by saying, yeah, dementia itself is like this big umbrella term. We're referring to the decline of one or more kind of functions of the brain. And then Alzheimer's disease is a specific subgenre of that that is the most common form of dementia in older adults, but there are other types too. So Austin, speaking of those other types too, because again, to your point you just made, you see a lot of dementia, but maybe not people who have clinically been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So what are these other types of dementia?
Yeah, the first is not actually a type of dementia, but it's kind of like a separate state that doesn't meet the full criteria for dementia. So you mentioned earlier that when people have this diagnosis, it really has to be something that interferes with their daily function, independence, ability to do their daily activities and kind of live their life as they did previously. And so if somebody has any degree of impairment, say in learning or memory or executive function like you outlined, but it does not materially impact their day-to-day life and function, then that's something that's oftentimes labeled as so-called mild cognitive impairment and not a full-blown kind of diagnosis of dementia. And it's not necessarily guaranteed either that somebody who has, you know, this diagnostic label of mild cognitive impairment will necessarily progress to dementia. It's not like a 100% sort of thing. But that's just something to differentiate those groups, those who are impaired in terms of their function as a result of this issue and those who are not. But there are a lot of other forms of dementia and other forms of what we'll call kind of neurodegenerative diseases that can manifest in different ways based on what parts of the brain are impacted and how they are impacted. So these are all types that I have seen, I have diagnosed, and I see on an ongoing basis and kind of teach my students regularly about these topics. So one, for example, is called Lewy body dementia or dementia with Lewy bodies. And that's just that Lewy body term is just describing some of the things that you might see under, again, microscopes that most of us are not really examining. And that's kind of a cousin of Parkinson's disease. Patients can have that impairment in their cognition, but they can also have various other manifestations. They might have some visual hallucinations, seeing like little people and animals and things like that. They can have movement disorders similar to Parkinson's disease, issues with sleep and various others. There's a different type called frontotemporal dementia, and that just describes other parts of the brain that are impacted. And the easiest way to understand that is that your normal kind of filter is kind of broken. And so these patients can manifest with a lot of personality changes and disinhibition and things like that, and eventually have some speech difficulties later on. Parkinson's disease itself can lead to a form of dementia, which again, primarily will manifest up front with the Parkinsonian type movement symptoms, and then the patients can develop dementia, you know, years later. And then finally, patients who've had strokes or various other kind of vascular issues affecting their brain can develop something called vascular dementia, where limitations in blood flow lead to kind of progressive cumulative damage to various areas of the brain. And the manifestations that the patient will have will depend on which areas of the brain have been impacted over time. There are even more than these, but these are some of the more common ones that we think about and look for in day-to-day practice.
Yeah, so I guess you see it a lot. Obviously, dementia is unfortunately common, and so people are going to be coming in with that in their sort of medical history. Are you ever diagnosing dementia while somebody's in the hospital? Like this is a new diagnosis, and then you're trying to work that up alongside maybe other conditions? Because you know, if somebody comes in sick, you're trying to figure out, well, why are they here? Like what led to this? So I assume you're doing some investigation, but kind of curious how that whole process plays out while they're in the hospital.
Yeah, it's very uncommon for me to make a new primary diagnosis of dementia on somebody in the hospital setting because typically they're coming in for some reason that necessitates them being in the hospital. Nobody needs to be in the hospital because they have memory loss. Well, I won't say nobody, but based on the usual trajectory of memory loss that we might see in dementia over the course of like years or something like that. And so there are occasional exceptions to that rule. So one example that I can think of that I saw maybe 2 years ago was a gentleman who got brought in because of, again, just kind of like this decline at home. The family wasn't really able to take care of him as well. And when I saw him and examined him, he had kind of characteristic features that looked kind of like Parkinson disease. And then his doctor had recently started him on a medicine, and that medicine made him way worse. And that kind of clued me into the possibility of dementia with Lewy bodies. And then when I talked to him, he was talking about seeing little toy soldiers marching around the room and things like that. And there we go. It was kind of a slam dunk diagnosis once I made sure he didn't have, you know, delirium or infections or anything else kind of unusual going on. But it was just a very prototypical textbook scenario. But those are the exception more than they are the rule. Most of the time people are coming in for some other reason. And if I sense that they have some impaired cognition, then that's something that I note. I'll treat all the things that are happening in the short term and then recommend that they get kind of a more thorough dementia evaluation when medically they're more stabilized and outside of the hospital.
Yeah, that's a big thing too with respect to the diagnosis, because it's not just, you know, a standard patient interview, you know, all right, what happened? How did you get here? What was going on around the time of you coming in, you know, for example? But with dementia, you're taking, you know, not only their personal history going back years, but also like family history going back generations to try to get a sense of like, is this early onset? Like, do you have some big genetic, you know, underlying risk, or is there some sort of a treatable cause acutely that's going on, you know, vitamin deficiency,
that's the most,
infection?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the most important thing, is to look for things that we can treat in reverse, because, you know, it's unfortunate if somebody receives a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and there's relatively little that we can do for it that's super effective. But there are things that can mimic and look a lot like dementia. So if all you needed was, you know, taking some high dose vitamin B12 supplements, or all you needed was a shot of penicillin to treat your syphilis, and that can cure your cognitive dysfunction, then that's something I'd want to know rather than just say, well, you got dementia, and shrug and kind of send you on your way.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. So let's pivot here. Let's talk about the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease, its diagnosis, and then some of the risk factors, which we're going to focus most of our attention on this podcast. And I think just to give folks a lay of the land, the main purpose of this podcast is that we know our audience primarily falls into one of three categories. One, like health professionals. So you definitely need to know about Alzheimer's and its potential effects with respect to modifying risk factors that we can. You're a fitness professional. It is highly probable you're going to see somebody with some form of dementia in various states, and you need to know, not only feel comfortable like working with them, but also have some background into know where to go to seek more information. So this podcast will be useful, as well as the links in the show notes. And then third is the strength enthusiast. And your primary role is to be this like social agent of change within your social group. You're the expert on exercise, and so having some knowledge on this with respect to Alzheimer's, because it is so common, dementia itself being even more common, having some knowledge about this is likely to be helpful when getting folks to change their behavior. So we talk about pathophysiology, so what's causing Alzheimer's disease, again, a subset of dementia in general. The pathogenesis of Alzheimer's still remains to this day unclear and is an active area of research and, dare I say, controversy. I mean, I don't know what goes on in the neurology conferences. I don't assume that they get, you know, they're screaming at each other or calling each other names, throwing, you know, Harrisons across the room. I don't know that they could do that. It's a pretty heavy, heavy book. But yeah, it's definitely an area of controversy and active research. So that all being said, pretty much all forms of Alzheimer's disease appear to share some sort of overproduction and or decreased clearance of a specific group of proteins in the brain called amyloid beta peptides. It's still unknown and, again, controversial, like if this is a neurotoxin or what the source of this neurotoxin is, and it's debated heavily. But experimental evidence suggests that relatively small groups of these amyloid beta peptides of proteins are likely to be causal. That's kind of where we're at. I don't want to give this short shrift, because I am interested in the pathophysiology, especially if it happens to be way different than this and we've kind of been barking up the wrong tree for a long time. But I'm not smart enough to know what that is right now. And dare I say it, I think you need a group of other people who are in the lab right now trying to figure this out to have some more time to come up with a better sort of pathophysiology. Would you agree with that, Austin?
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, some situations where, for example, in like early onset disease and patients with like very identifiable genetic risk factors and mutations in their ability to metabolize and clear some of these proteins. And that's kind of what, in part, you know, led to some of the suspicion around that as the main kind of driver of this disease. I think that, you know, it's not necessarily panned out exactly as we would like when it comes to translating this into effective treatments. And so then it raises the question of like, well, is all of this, you know, Alzheimer's disease the same mechanistically, or are there different ways that you can get to this end state, or are there other things that we've not yet detected? This is a huge, you know, research industry that's been going on for a long time, and there's actually been a lot of actually nefarious stuff that has kind of emerged in recent years that's been unfortunate in that world of literature as well. Some retractions and some research fraud and all sorts of other nonsense that you would wish had never happened, because it's led people down on a wild goose chase for an unfortunately long time. So complex, controversial, nobody really understands it all that well. Otherwise, I think we would have made more progress by this point. So it's a tough one for sure.
Yeah, I agree. So with that murky pathophysiology aside, let's move into diagnosis. Now, you alluded to this earlier, that the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is predominantly clinical, which means that you're taking a constellation of signs and symptoms and kind of piecing it together and saying, eh, this smells like Alzheimer's. I'm going to label it Alzheimer's because it seems to be the best fit. The definitive diagnosis requires, you know, examination of brain tissue. So you got to like take a brain biopsy, which is generally inadvisable in living patients, just as a general rule. And so most studies of Alzheimer's disease rely on this these clinical criteria to define cases, which have changed over time. And that's important to note because much of the older literature has not distinguished between Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Some of them have, but again, since this criteria has evolved as we've learned more and more, some of the older data is less sort of applicable unless you look at it through that lens and have more understanding here. So as of this recording, the National Institute on Aging and the Alzheimer's Association, the NIAAA, that's what I was trying to think of earlier, their criteria for probable Alzheimer's disease dementia requires the presence of dementia and the following characteristics: a decline in overall function, which they define as the interference with ability to function at work or at usual activities. And that has to be a decline from a previous level of functioning and performing that is not explained by delirium or major psychiatric disorder. Just quickly before we move on, Austin, you want to talk about like what delirium is, just so we don't confuse our listenership?
Sure. Yeah. Delirium is something that I see probably even more than I see dementia in the hospital. And to just the most fundamental level differentiating it, we talked about dementia as an issue with cognition, various aspects of thinking and decision making and things like that. Delirium is instead a disorder of attention. And so this is something where if I see somebody in the hospital and they can be hyperactive and agitated and acting out and not really able to like fixate and focus and follow a train of thought and maintain attention, or they could be what we call hypoactive, where they're kind of like look almost sedated, but inside their brain doesn't know which way is up, basically. So delirium, much more a disorder of attention that kind of waxes and wanes in the setting of other illnesses, whereas dementia is a much more long-term decline in cognition, typically, whereas attention is not necessarily as impacted.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. So in addition to this decline in overall function, again, from a previous level, there also needs to be cognitive impairment, which is established by history taking, talking to the patient, and a knowledgeable informant. Because if somebody shows up either at the clinic or the hospital by themselves, it's going to be difficult to get an accurate history for them, particularly if they're impaired. And they might say, oh, everything's fine, doc. And you might just take, if you take that at face value, you're kind of barking up the wrong tree. And so in addition to that, there's usually objective mental status examinations that occur at the bedside and some neuropsychological testing that happens usually in the outpatient setting, but not always. And then there needs to also be some impaired ability to require or remember new information. So memory, impaired reasoning or handling of complex tasks, poor judgment, or impaired visual spatial abilities, impaired language functions, so like word finding, word recognition, and so on, changes in personality, behavior, or other comportment. And there are other core clinical criteria here. So usually it's insidious onset. So rather than acute, something happening, you know, the drop of a hat, and a clear-cut history of it worsening. And finally, there has to be no evidence of another cause. So some sort of substantial component of cerebrovascular disease, vascular dementia, for example, or if it looks like Lewy body dementia, you can't really call that Alzheimer's, or if it has some sort of frontotemporal dementia, which again, we talked about earlier, has its kind of characteristic findings, in other types of non-neurologic, you know, origin diseases. So whether it's delirium, depression, B12 deficiency, hypothyroid, neurosyphilis, other infectious things. Basically, it can't be anything else. And you see that all the time in other conditions that have this sort of cluster of criteria. Depressive disorders, for example, come to mind immediately. So yeah, that's the current criteria for diagnosing this. And it's a clinical diagnosis, again, difficult to do without a high level of training. And again, further, the definitive diagnosis tends to be done post-mortem. Autopsy is when usually if people do that, you get a brain tissue, look at it under a microscope. But in general, the initial and most prominent cognitive deficits are usually one of the following. The most common is probably this amnestic presentation, so an impairment in learning and recall of recently learned information. This is the most common initial symptom, And it's pretty characteristic. Whereas declarative memory, that's memory of events at a particular time and place, are mostly affected. Later, Alzheimer's can progress to memory of facts and vocabulary. That's called semantic memory. But initially, early on, it's like this declarative memory seems to be primarily affected. That seems to be related to different neuroanatomy differences and like where those types of memory are kind of heavily leveraging. But again, that's kind of beyond the scope of this particular podcast. Some neuroanatomist who's listening to this is like shaking their fist, like, come on, talk about all the different areas, the Brodmann areas and such. That's for a different podcast, sir. So that's the amnestic presentation. There's also a non-amnestic presentation, which sometimes happens. That can include like a language-based presentation where people have word-finding deficits, can be a visual-spatial presentation where people have visual and cognitive deficits mixed together, or this dissecutive presentation, prominent impairments in reasoning, judgment, and problem-solving. There are also, again, other signs and symptoms associated with the Alzheimer's disease, including disturbances in movement, smell, so olfactory sense, sleep, seizure activity, and so on. And finally, as you know, most things pertaining to the human experience, people can present atypically. They don't always read the book on Alzheimer's disease. So atypical presentations occur in about 6 to 14% of autopsy-confirmed cases. So it's not exactly a zebra when you hear hoofbeats, but still should be in the back of your mind. Overall here, the takeaway is that Alzheimer's disease is typically a clinical diagnosis based on a collection of symptoms and findings relating to cognitive function that are not otherwise explained by a different condition or combination of conditions. Austin, do you feel satisfied with that kind of description of what Alzheimer's disease is?
Yes, I think we've spent enough time in those weeds.
Yep. All right, let's get out of the weeds, get the weed whacker. All right, so let's talk about some epidemiology, how many people are affected. I kind of alluded to this in the intro, that Alzheimer's disease is unfortunately common. According to recent data, the global number of people with Alzheimer's disease is estimated to be at about 32 million. Okay. Those with a similar presentation and laboratory evidence of Alzheimer's disease, but who don't quite have enough symptoms to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, is estimated to be about 69 million adults worldwide. And the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in developed countries is about 5 to 7% overall, and a lifetime risk for the individual is about 10 to 12%. So again, not uncommon, unfortunately, and it's highly likely if you're listening to this, you know somebody in your family or in your social circle who's dealt with this or is dealing with this. And this is important also, in addition to just not wanting to develop this, this is a very common cause of death in older adults. So dementia is second to heart failure as a leading cause of mortality, accounting for about 20% of deaths in older adults, those over the age of 65. Though this is likely an underestimate, as dementia is often underreported as a cause of death, which I can see, like if somebody ends up coming to the hospital for like pneumonia, for example, they may get pulmonary infection or respiratory failure or whatever is like their cause of death, when the reason why they got the, infection is because of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's one of the more common, actually, things that I might see. They, you know, over time, their ability to, you know, manage their own food intake and chew and swallow and kind of control that all normally can decline. And so it's extremely common for that to lead to, you know, what we call aspiration or sucking food down the wrong way. And that can lead to issues in the lungs and pneumonia and respiratory failure and things like that. So that's doesn't surprise me when I see that, as unfortunate as it is. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to risk factors here. And we'll start off with the bad news, the non-modifiable risk factors, although some of these may change maybe in our lifetime. First one I don't think is going to change in our lifetime, but, you know, maybe. Age is one of the biggest non-modifiable risk factors with respect to Alzheimer's disease, and it is increasingly prevalent with advancing age. So, for example, in the United States in 2011, there were 4.5 million individuals over the age of 65 living with Alzheimer's disease, that had a clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And that included 0.7 million people ages 65 to 74, 2.3 million people age 75 to 84, and 1.8 million people 85 and older. It just, the risk keeps going up as people age. Mm-hmm. The second thing that, again, is non-modifiable right now, although maybe CRISPR is coming into play here for us, is genetics. And the first one I want to address, and this is where I think that podcast is going to get spicy, so don't go anywhere. This should be spicy at the end of this particular section, is apolipoprotein epsilon-4, it's APOE4 gene. Now, this is used in many functions within the body, but it's primarily concerned with transporting cholesterol and fats around the blood and the brain. About 60 to 80% of Alzheimer's patients have at least one copy of the APOE4 gene. And having a copy of this gene is also associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And if you were trying to make a Venn diagram of like risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and cardiovascular disease, it would look more like a circle. And so it does seem to have not only same similar genetic underlying risk factors, but also modifiable risk factors we'll get to later. The average lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's is about 10 to 12%. And the risk at least doubles with the presence of a first degree relative with this disorder. And so despite its limited utility, kind of burying the lead here, patients express concern over their risk and in some instances request genetic testing. So the presence of this APOE4 allele increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease in a dose-dependent fashion. So that means folks with two copies of this allele, so they're homozygous, are at the highest risk. Estimates of the increased risk via this APOE4 gene vary widely and also differ based on age and gender. The typical estimate suggests for those who have one copy of this APOE4 gene, that's a 2 to 3-fold increased risk in developing Alzheimer's disease, whereas if you have two copies, the risk seems to go up from anywhere between 2 to 10 times. And so you can understand why people will say, look, I've had a first degree relative or somebody in my family, even if they're second degree relative who had Alzheimer's disease. I want to know, am I at risk? That makes sense to me, like wanting to know that. But does that mean that asymptomatic individuals should get tested, right? So here's where we're going to ask, put Austin on the spot, see if he's got any hot takes. So there are concerns related to genetic testing for Alzheimer's disease risk factors like APOE4 gene, for example, as this may trigger an untoward psychological response, such as severe depression, anxiety, or even suicidal ideation. You can imagine if you get a blood test back that says you're homozygous for E4, APOE4, and you saw your parent had have a steep decline later in life. You might not be well served by that. Although there's been some evidence kind of looking at folks who have had their genes tested to see how they respond. It seems that when people do this, that folks who find out that they have one of these genes, the way that they respond depends on how the information was communicated to them. So
what a concept.
So basically they're able to like recall the information in certain ways, depending on how it was communicated to them. Yeah. And approximately half of the participants who correctly recalled the risk information actually believed the risk was significantly different than what was disclosed to them. So even like if you do a good job as a clinician, like people may not remember that correctly. Another finding, and this is maybe potentially beneficial, is that folks who got their genetic testing done for APOE4, they were more likely to report healthy behavior changes, including the use of dietary supplements, which we'll get into here a little bit later. Although improvements in health behavior may be a beneficial outcome, there's some concern that such individuals will be vulnerable to marketing of treatments or supplements in the absence of evidence-based recommendations. And so it is not recommended. The current guidelines suggest against direct-to-consumer APOE4 genetic testing. And there's a few reasons for that. One, the APOE4 gene in and of itself has low sensitivity and specificity for predicting Alzheimer's disease risk. So that just means that if you have it, we're unsure like how this is going to correlate to your disease risk because there are many other risk factors. In addition to that lack of sensitivity and specificity, there's really a lack of preventative sort of things you can do outside of some of the healthy behaviors we're going to talk about here later. And again, we can't really give you a risk number because it does seem to vary based on gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, where you live in the world, things of that nature. And so it's like, okay, you have one of the APOE4 genes. Okay, you'd prefer to maybe not have that, but I still don't know what it means. And so there's some difficulty in conveying the risk. And if you don't do a good job, apparently patients can misremember. The current recommendation is against direct-to-consumer APOE4 testing. So that just means you could just buy it on the internet. And there's actually the Choosing Wisely campaign, which Austin and I are big fans of in general. This is their quote from that. They say, apolipoprotein E is a susceptibility gene for later onset Alzheimer's disease, the most common cause of dementia. The presence of this E4 allele is neither necessary nor sufficient to cause Alzheimer's disease. And the relative risk conferred by the E4 allele is confounded by the presence of other risk alleles, also gender, environment, and possible ethnicity. Apolipoprotein E genotyping for Alzheimer's disease risk prediction has limited clinical utility and poor predictive value. Pretty strong statement overall. Yeah. So thoughts on genetic testing here for APOE4?
Yeah, this is admittedly a tricky area. I can understand a lot of the arguments that you have kind of quoted from some of these organizations. I can draw not exactly an analogous situation, but something we've talked about before, for example, is when people get lipoprotein little a checked. And that's something that is pretty heavily genetically determined, confers a pretty significantly increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease early if it is high. And at the moment, we don't have a ton of great interventions to substantially lower it. We have some things, but not a ton. And so for most people, it's not directly actionable at this time unless they are able to go out of their way and get on a PCSK9 inhibitor or get enrolled in a clinical trial, for even though that's likely to change actually quite soon, I think. So, you know, the idea and like European cardiovascular guidelines are all saying everybody should be screened for this. Even in US guidelines, you know, it's something that can be used for further risk assessment or for people with early, you know, family history of cardiovascular disease and things like that. So it's a somewhat analogous, but not perfectly analogous situation, because the interpretation of an LP little a level is more straightforward than interpretation of multiple different, you know, allele polymorphisms of APOE4. You know, on one hand, I see what these organizations are saying. On the other, you know, in the same way that, you know, it's been advised that, hey, if you are otherwise, you know, seemingly average risk, or maybe you have a family history, but you don't have anything else going on, and checking an LP little a means, and it's high, means we're going to like go super aggressive in terms of managing all the other risk factors that we can, your blood pressure and your blood sugar and physical activity and lowering your other lipid, you know, fractions as much as we can. You know, to the point that you quoted about some of these folks who heard or learned of their genotype and then suddenly instituted much more lifestyle measures than they would have otherwise, that is something that, you know, is plausible to me, is not a crazy idea. And it fundamentally comes down to like, I think a bit, I don't know if what the right word is, paternalistic or myopic or what, to assume that like all people who get this gene testing done are going to respond in the same way to that. And they're all going to suddenly like want to commit suicide if they find out, right? I think different people are going to respond to this differently at baseline. And then the skill and expertise of the clinician delivering this information and how it's framed, and here's what we can do with, you know, with this information, here's what we should do with this information, I think we can mold a lot of people's understanding and their subsequent actions. And so while those organizations have some valid points, those who would argue that, hey, you know, if I get checked and I find out I'm particularly high risk, I'm going to lean even harder into all this aggressive risk factor modification and cranking up my exercise and being much more rigid about adhering to one of these dietary patterns that we'll get into in a little bit that actually seem to have some effect on delaying the onset potentially of dementia. So I'm not ultimately coming down firmly in one position on this, because I don't know that it would be wise to broadly, like on a population level at this time. I think that might change, but I'm just recognizing that like different people are going to have a different like tolerance for risk, desire to know their risk, interest in acting based on, you know, refined risk kind of projections and estimates. And so I view this more on like a case by case basis. If somebody's like, well, I have all this strong family history, I want to know my like some kind of uniquely elevated risk, because I would go way harder on this stuff if I knew or something, and that's their motivate, then fine, you know. But if somebody's like, I don't want to know, I'm at just average risk, do less, then fine too.
Yeah, surprisingly, we have similar views on this. I don't like the idea of like daddy healthcare being like, no, you can't access this, just as a general rule. And the test is not prohibitively expensive for people who would, I guess, be able to modify a lot of their risk factors. I think it's like $100 for a test. It's not nothing, to be clear, but like, you know, if the $100 is going to break you, which I understand that's some people's financial situation, I have more concerns about the modifiable risk factors and their ability to do so otherwise. I guess where I come down to, because I am agreeing that if this is going to make somebody change their behavior to a greater degree than not having the test, I'm just curious as to why, right? Because it's like, look, I can't really interpret the way the test is going to come back, because there are too many unknown variables, not only other alleles, but other like, you know, your ethnicity, gender, where you live, there's just too many other factors for me to give you like a number. I could just tell you, generally speaking, like probably more or probably, you know, less compared to if you had two copies or zero copies, right? I guess I would just try to frame that like, yeah, why don't you just assume you're high risk and then go send it? Because in addition to like, if with behavior change, because in addition to like reducing your risk of Alzheimer's disease, regardless of your genetic makeup, all of the other medical conditions that we've ever talked about on this podcast are likely to be benefited by you taking those additional steps anyway. So if we're just thinking about health broadly speaking, why wouldn't you maximize your risk factors, right? So in anyway, I'm in a roundabout way of getting to this. The only time I think I would make like a great case for this is if somebody was like really on the fence about maybe taking like a statin, for example, right? And like there was no other testing indicated that like probably you would benefit from doing this. And they're like, I don't know, doc. And you're like, let's get an ApoE, you know, like if that was a thing, or like taking a blood pressure medication or something to of that nature, right? If they really needed an extra bit of information to put them over the edge because they otherwise would not actually change their behavior, I'm fine with it. And even if it doesn't change somebody's behavior, I'm still kind of okay with it if it's explained in the right way up front. Like, we don't really know what this means. We have some sense of what it means, but this isn't like either a death sentence, thing one. And then thing two, it's also not like, oh, you're out of jail. Do whatever you want if you have no copies, right? It's just more like something we know exists, but we're still unsure like what it means. If it's framed that way, maybe it's less attractive, but also mm-hmm. maybe less like harmful potentially. I don't know. I do worry though, just like there's a lot of commercial stuff out there right now for like, oh, direct to consumer, like nutrigenomics testing or like whatever. And it's like, bro, if you go down that rabbit hole, like, you know,
you're gonna get preyed on. Yeah.
Take half the money you were gonna spend, send it to me. I have some charities that I'm involved with. Like, I can take care of that for you. Everybody be better for it. So and I should say that not all genetic testing related to Alzheimer's disease is this controversial. So there are known genetic variants that are associated with early onset Alzheimer's disease. And so people who have a first degree relative who had early onset Alzheimer's disease and who are, you know, thinking about having children or otherwise concerned with the risk. Yeah, the current guidelines say, hey, it's okay to test these folks for genetic conditions relating to the amyloid beta precursor protein, presenilin 1, presenilin 2. Or if people were adopted, for example, they don't know their family history. That's like guidelines recommended that folks can get genetic testing and counseling. The direct-to-consumer stuff does kind of worry me on some level as a general rule, because I'm like, who's interpreting this?
That's the main concern for a lot of this stuff is it's either uninterpretable testing that you probably should have never gotten because maybe it was some endocrine test that was measured at the wrong time or the wrong context or something, yeah. Or it's ordered and then, you know, you don't know how to interpret it. So then you take it to a clinician who has no context for the interpretation and has to start from the very beginning and then question, you know, a lot of things. So.
There's one of these fly-by-night telehealth companies online who has underqualified individuals working for them. They'll remain nameless just because I don't really feel like dealing with any legal battles at this particular point. They pointed out, they were like, oh, look, we diagnosed Hashimoto's, you know, long before their primary care doctor would have, like, diagnosed it because they ordered this extensive panel, but that you otherwise probably wouldn't have ordered until the patient was either had some symptoms, right? Or otherwise a need to order this expanded panel. And he's like, look at what we did. Hooray. Right. And the expanded panel is like 18 different things long. And they happen to catch, you know, these three items that do in fact point towards Hashimoto's. And I'm like, cool, you caught it 2 years earlier and they have no clinical symptoms right now. So not only is this kind of like a, what do we do about it? Cause you don't need to treat it. And the risks of treating it right now probably outweigh the benefits. Cause like you have no symptoms. There's no like real reason to treat it. Why would you do it? And so you're going to have to test it again later. Like, really, you just spent more money than you need to for no apparent benefit, but that's what you get if you're not actually like a healthcare provider and you're just, you know, ordering everything. Shotgun approach. Anyway. All right, let's move on. So that's the non-modifiable stuff, age and genetics. In general, as people age, they tend to have a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's, and there's some genetic risks of unknown sort of clinical utility at this point outside of the early onset stuff, but that's a little more clear cut. As far as modifiable risk factors, a lot of these things are going to sound familiar to those who've been listening to our podcast for a while. So we're going to start out with Austin's favorite, high blood pressure. If you were an advocate for any type of screening test, I think it would be blood pressure screening. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah. what would be your number two? Is it going to be like a depression screen or something, or like a...
I'd have to give that some more thought. Probably not a depression screen, no, because I'm not terribly impressed by the data for primary care screening of depression either. Okay. But yeah, it would fall into one of our other kind of major cardiometabolic risk factors probably. So it could probably be like insulin resistance related or lipid-based, something like that.
A1C, probably. Yeah, something like that, LDL-C, sure. So for high blood pressure or hypertension, this is a big modifiable risk factor with respect to Alzheimer's disease. And this is especially true, we're talking about midlife hypertension. So when people are in their 40s or 50s, it's consistently been associated with an increased risk of dementia in many studies. Now, the risk is probably mediated through cerebrovascular disease as the effect of cumulative exposure to long-term elevated blood pressure. I'll read that again. The risk of high blood pressure with respect to Alzheimer's disease is probably mediated through cerebrovascular disease, those are just blood vessels in the brain, as the effect of a cumulative exposure to long-term elevations in resting blood pressure. And we've talked about cumulative exposure on this podcast, well, I don't know how many times, but lots of times. But we're not talking about blood pressure that's elevated for 1 day, 1 hour, 1 month, or even 1 year. We're talking about 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And the sooner that you can intervene or avoid that entirely, that's proportional to your risk reduction. Because it's interesting when you look at some of the data here, most observational studies do show that treating high blood pressure or hypertension reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease and Alzheimer's disease progression. But some clinical trials don't show a benefit when the follow-up is short-term. So, for example, if it's a six-month trial on lowering somebody's blood pressure, my prediction would be that that wouldn't affect Alzheimer's disease risk at all. One, because you're not going to pick up enough new cases for you to really know, like, does this work? And further, you don't have enough cumulative exposure to a reduction in blood pressure for it to make a difference, right? If you look at people in their 70s and you're like, yeah, we reduced their blood pressure on average, you know, down to normal levels for 6 months. I'm like, hey, that's great, better than 0 months. But I don't know what the clinical effect of that is unless we, you know, chart that out for 10 years, 20 years or longer. Does that kind of jibe with what you're thinking about this?
Yeah, it's the same thing we've talked about with, like, when studies look, take a, you know, a 78-year-old person and put them on a statin for 6 months, and then you don't see a huge change because their cumulative lifelong exposure to blood cholesterol has not been materially impacted. And by that point in the game, they have the, you know, atherosclerosis that they've built up over those 7 decades of life, 8 decades of life already. So the same thing applies here. And the other thing I would add is that, you know, we're talking about this in the context of Alzheimer's disease, but high blood pressure is the biggest risk factor, modifiable risk factor for stroke, and strokes can then cause vascular dementia. So if you address blood pressure as early as possible and keep it controlled throughout life via lifestyle or medications or whatever, you're not only impacting your Alzheimer disease risk, but also at least as importantly, if not more importantly, your risk of vascular dementia by preventing strokes.
Would you, for more spicy takes, would you be okay with permitting somebody to walk around at, you know, 125 over 80?
I would say that somebody who walks around at 125 over 80 is probably at some degree of higher risk compared with somebody who is at 120 or 115 over 80 or 75 or 70. The absolute magnitude of that risk increase is probably pretty small. Some people fall under the camp of, like, quote unquote, optimizers or maximizers, as they've sometimes been labeled in these conversations. They're willing to do anything and everything they possibly can to reduce the risk of any bad event in their life. And other people are going to be more healthcare minimizers and say, I'm not interested in really doing much of anything. And then most people probably fall somewhere in between. And so that's kind of where this theoretical concept of shared decision making comes into play, even though I'm skeptical that people can truly have, like, fully informed, you know, shared decision making a lot of the time in this, just because people are really bad at interpreting numbers and risk data, including physicians. So that's kind of how I would handle this in practice, is that if I had somebody with that blood pressure range, trying to get a sense of, like, you know, are there any lifestyle factors that I can encourage them to do more, whether for the purpose of that blood pressure lowering or just to get them healthier in general? And then if they're tending towards maximizer, I want to do everything possible, then there's a conversation to be had about lowering their blood pressure.
Yeah. Just imagine if you had to exercise for another 3 hours every week to lower your blood pressure another 6 millimeters of mercury, or you could just take, you know, the
take
lowest dose.
2.5 of amlodipine or something.
Yeah. 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 And you're like, hey, man. All right. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. So that's high blood pressure. Again, no surprise here. Cumulative exposure to elevated resting blood pressure over the course of your life is an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. One of the biggest modifiable risk factors for not only Alzheimer's, but certainly, as you discussed, vascular dementia, secondary to stroke. For example, today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Now, Acorns is an investment platform, also have a bunch of educational tools on their website. I thought they had a pretty good product, so thought I would let them sponsor our podcast. They make it easy to automatically start saving and investing for the future. You don't actually need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can start with just your spare change. With Roundups, that's a program that they have to round up any purchase made from a linked account, debit or credit card, to the next dollar that goes into your retirement or investment account. They also have Acorns Early, which is an investment account for kids, and they recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head over to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. You can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Second modifiable risk factor we're going to talk about here, again, not surprising to anyone who's listened to a lot of our content before, is high cholesterol. Although I will say that the data here is complex. Most epidemiological studies have reported a correlation between elevated total or total cholesterol or low density lipoprotein cholesterol levels and Alzheimer's disease. Then again, elevated cholesterol levels are often part of a cluster of other conditions that are involved in Alzheimer's disease risk. So things like high blood pressure, insulin resistance, obesity, and so on. It's very rare that high cholesterol just pops up in isolation on its own, for example. Interestingly, peripheral blood low-density lipoprotein, so LDL, does not cross the blood-brain barrier unless the barrier is damaged by factors such as vascular disease. Now, most of the cholesterol in the brain is synthesized by astrocytes and neurons. Those are just specialized cells within the brain. And cholesterol is provided to brain cells by high-density lipoprotein complexes. There's basically little to no low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, in the brain. Nonetheless, observational data generally supports an association between elevated LDL or total cholesterol at midlife and the risk of Alzheimer's disease. In one longitudinal cohort study, high cholesterol at midlife, so the mean age of this was 50 years, conferred a 3-fold higher odds of Alzheimer's disease independent of the APOE4 genotype, education level, smoking status, and alcohol consumption. Other studies have reported similar results. Interestingly, the study we both just got into our inbox not too long ago showed that statin treatment also reduced the risk of dementia in those with elevated cholesterol, in those with and without dementia, even at a far advanced age. They were in their 80s. And, you know, if you talk to people, physicians about statin use in like people in their 80s and 90s, they're like, we don't know, man. Like, it's just too old. We don't really know. Yet somehow there's this like persistence of fear around statins causing dementia, even though we have this data. I don't know. What's your take on that, Baraki?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the world of cholesterol skeptics, quote unquote, in general, and statin skeptics in particular, this is a pretty common talking point there. And it is I suspect, comes back to some sort of kind of mechanistic theorizing around, somebody will cite like, oh, well, your brain is mostly fat or mostly cholesterol based. And so statins, of course, have to be bad for your brain. And, you know, that, as we've described before, that's another example of smooth brain reasoning, not smooth brain reasoning, not induced by statins, clearly. But the overall body of evidence on this does not seem to show that statin use increases the rates in incidence or progression of cognitive dysfunction, broadly speaking. And so if the claim is that it does that, broadly speaking, I would say that's not supported. If the claim is that it does that in particular subgroups, that would need to be shown. If it is that certain statins are higher risk for this than others, that would also need to be shown. I've read some theories around that having to do with some of the pharmacology of certain statins versus others, but even that is a bit fuzzy as well. So I think that, you know, this area is, as you said, complex and a bit fuzzy. And then similar to the last one, there's also an overlap with the risk of vascular dementia, because atherosclerosis affecting the cerebral vessels, the, you know, the carotids and the vessels in the brain and things like that, can also lead to stroke, and that can lead to vascular dementia. So there's yet another reason, aside from just Alzheimer's, that you should, you know, pay attention to this, and similar to blood pressure, have it as controlled as you can as early in life as you can.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, control your blood pressure early on in life as well as you can. Same thing with the cholesterol levels. And then it brings us to our next risk factor, which is insulin resistance. Now, a large number of prospective population-based studies have found that diabetes is associated with an approximately 1.5 to 2-fold increase in the relative risk of cognitive decline and dementia later in life. There's an unclear mechanism relating to an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, but it's likely related to both vascular disease, because we know that elevated fasting blood sugar tends to be associated with atherosclerosis, and possible hippocampal atrophy due to high blood sugar levels. All right, what's the hippocampus? Well, it's a small area of the brain that's heavily involved in not only memory, short and long term, but also it's primarily affected within Alzheimer's disease. So there may be some selective hippocampal atrophy due to high blood sugar levels within the brain. And so this may be one of the mechanisms by which folks with insulin resistance tend to have a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. There's also some mechanisms going around with like hyperinsulinemia with respect to what has happening at the level of the brain, particularly with relationship to this amyloid beta protein we talked about earlier and amyloid beta metabolism. So for example, there's an insulin degrading enzyme, IDE, and it's suggested that when there's insulin resistance, there's higher insulin levels in the blood, less insulin levels in the brain, and less insulin degrading enzyme in the brain. And that causes decreased amyloid clearance, because that enzyme is apparently used to break down amyloid. Whether or not this is true, I don't know. This was first reported over 20 years ago, and subsequent studies have not, like, you know, been outpouring from the research saying, this is what's happening. So I don't know. You can find a bunch of rat studies and, you know, maybe make a protocol and make millions of dollars a year just advertising a certain protocol that has no real clinical evidence. But we don't do that here in the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Rather than fame, we opt for nuance. And there are other studies that are investigating a possible role for the accumulation of advanced glycation end products, which you might have seen online by various people referring to them as AGES, A-G-E apostrophe S. This is basically when you have elevated blood sugar floating around and it can tag itself to various tissues. And people say, oh, advanced glycation end products, this is the mechanism. May be involved, but again, that been first reported, you know, over 20 years ago. And we think it's more of something that happens with high levels of blood sugar as a function of insulin resistance, which has its own pathophysiology. And so whether that's causal for how this relates to Alzheimer's disease in particular is kind of unknown. And rather than focusing on that mechanism, I'd focus even further upstream on, well, how do we treat insulin resistance? Well, that's usually with weight loss. That's usually with exercise. That's potentially with other medications to keep blood sugar levels within a normal range. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, let's just attack the outcomes, right? And we can work the mechanisms out later. If there are new mechanisms that pop up that lead to different sort of treatments, great. We'll be first in line. But I'm waiting for clinical data there.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think we need to worry about these tiny details so much when it comes to telling or advising people on what they should do for this.
Hear, hear. All right, moving on. Obesity, again, no surprise that excess adiposity, excess body fat is a risk for Alzheimer's disease. That is a risk for pretty much everything else outside of maybe like hernias, as it turns out. apparently people who have higher BMIs and excess body fat have a lower incidence of hernias, but that's for another podcast. So similar to type 2 diabetes, obesity is associated with an approximately 1.5-fold increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. And as with other risk factors, so including the things we talked about, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, insulin resistance, the data are strongest for midlife obesity and more mixed for later in life, which isn't the relationship you see later on in some studies. But what's happening here is that as people age, they tend to develop more medical conditions. And some of those will make folks lose weight, whether it's due to the inability to feed themselves, whether it's weight loss that's unexpected due to like cancer, for example, and their BMI will drop. But they could still have an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease due to other reasons. But the relationship between like BMI and Alzheimer's disease risk tends to kind of taper off when people get into their 70s and 80s because there are other medical conditions going on. Weight loss later in life is more closely related to mild cognitive impairment, for example, than actual Alzheimer's disease, which is, you know, something that maybe there might be behavioral changes occurring due to the mild cognitive impairment rather than it causing the mild cognitive impairment itself. Now, this is maybe the most interesting thing. I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're already, you know, 50 minutes into this podcast. But again, we've been talking about this cumulative exposure to risk factors. And I've seen this number thrown around a number of times in the research as I was digging in here, that there's this sort of lag time between structural changes that you can observe in the brain that relate to Alzheimer's disease and the actual development of Alzheimer's disease that can be clinically diagnosed. And they predict on average is about 20 years. It's about 20 years. And so it's funny when you chart like the changes in death from Alzheimer's disease and like changes in obesity prevalence, that these things seem to match up on that 20-year delay. Like as we see an increase in obesity risk, 20 years later, we see a spike in Alzheimer's disease risk. We don't have to go over the numbers because people are going to forget about them later. But I just want to drive home the point that it's this cumulative exposure. And so, I don't know, I just turned 39. And so health and like longevity is definitely becoming more and more to the front of mind. And I'm starting to think like, well, fortunately, I kind of have been taking this stuff seriously from a relatively young age. And I've been blessed, you know, whether you call it genetics or just how I happenstance in life. But I think that unfortunately, people get a little bit too far along in life for you to make like these huge changes. It doesn't mean that the changes aren't beneficial. It just means that their like potential risk reduction has been compromised due to when you're, you know, able to make a change. What do you think about that, Austin?
Yeah, the longer you're exposed to these things before you intervene, the less bang for your buck you get by doing something about it. I think that's the succinct way to explain that concept. Yeah,
I like that soundbite. Yeah, we can use that for advertising. All right. Last few things here, as far as risk factors go, one's going to be exercise. So yeah, no surprise, physically active individuals have lower incidences and prevalence of cognitive decline and dementia, and this includes Alzheimer's disease. A meta-analysis of 16 prospective studies suggested a 28% reduction in overall dementia and a 45% reduction in Alzheimer's disease among those with the highest levels of physical activity compared with those who were the least active. So it seems like there's this dose-dependent relationship. However, and, you know, we could just stop it there and be like, yes, exercise, hooray. But, you know, again, we choose nuance over protocols here. So nuance here is that this may be confounded by a subtle behavior change or subtle behavioral changes that occur with neurodegenerative diseases. So maybe folks are likely to exercise less, for example, if they have a mild cognitive impairment, if they have some other type of dementia. So, for example, this other study in 4,000 older adults, those with higher physical activity levels at baseline did have a lower risk of dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, during the following four-year follow-up. But as we kind of talked about earlier, 4 years, like, who gives a shit? Like, what happens at 40 years, right? Well, at 14 years, when they followed these people up, that relationship had disappeared. And so it may be that you're just capturing people at a time where the behavior change secondary to neurodegenerative disorders has, like, started to take place. And so maybe you're testing for you're using a different test to identify the same sort of disease. That makes sense. Like, oh, lack of exercise. Well, that person may be more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease, not because they're not exercising, but because the behavior changes underlying the resistance to exercising are actually associated with having a neurodegenerative disorder already. Is that, how does that strike you?
Yeah, I mean, we see some similar thought process when people look at studies relating like how much exercise can reduce your risk of depression from like more observational data that like, yeah, but people who have depression are, you know, going to have a harder time engaging in, you know, a ton of exercise as well. I think regardless of any of that, I think that, you know, aside from these medical things that we've been talking about, like blood pressure control and things like that, staying physically active and like ideally, as we've talked about, meeting or exceeding physical activity guidelines, I think for me is probably like the strongest recommendation that I would make for people as it relates to kind of lifestyle impact on dementia risk. Regardless of whether the data are confounded or not, that is probably like the biggest thing that I would advise people to do and maintain is staying physically active as much and as long as possible.
Yep. Yep. I would agree with that. There's a few other risk factors. We won't spend time on this. So I'll just mention them because to give you guys a more complete picture here. So education is definitely a big thing with respect to basically all neurology type disorders, because you need to know, well, how much education has this person had when you're trying to say, like, what was their baseline? What's their current function? But yeah, there's a reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease the more education that people seem to have, maybe more cognitive reserve, if you like that term, versus like physiological reserve. Also, it affects how you're testing people. I remember when we were given like MoCA exams, those Montreal cognitive assessments, you had to know, well, how much education has this person had? So that seems to be a risk factor. Other things like history of traumatic brain injury, environmental pollution also seem to confer some sort of risk. But overall, the risk factors for vascular disease like hypertension, diabetes, smoking, obesity, low physical activity, and high cholesterol seem to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Again, the Venn diagram between like heart disease and Alzheimer's disease is more like a circle than an actual Venn diagram. So to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, these risk factors should be optimally managed as soon as possible. That's kind of the idea here, right? Don't have to wait to your 50s to do something about it. You can do it right now. As far as modifying these things, let's start with exercise. And I think broadly speaking, we can talk about indirect and direct sort of effects. Indirect effects of exercise have to do with all the risk factors we just talked about. Yep, you can reduce resting blood pressure with exercise. Yep, you can reduce the amount of LDL-C or atherogenic cholesterol lipoproteins circulating through your bloodstream with exercise to some degree. You can reduce body fat with exercise. You can reduce insulin resistance. You can improve cerebral blood flow. Great. Exercise can do all of those things. As far as the direct effects of exercise, well, there's some other stuff going on there too, but I would like to say there's some issues with the data here. When you look at observational studies, most of them just report physical activity, which is not the same as exercise, right? Physical activity is any movement of the body created by the muscles that increases the energy use above resting levels, whereas exercise or exercise training is a subset of physical activity that is planned, repetitive, and structured to improve or maintain health or fitness. So when studies are looking at physical activity, especially on like an observational study, when they do it surveys, they are not like just defining exercise. They're including, yep, formal exercise, occupational activity, activities around the house that aren't really exercise, but it's not, you know, it's still activity. So there's some issues with some of the data here. So if you go and read some of the stuff, just be prepared for that. Mechanism-wise, there's a bunch of cool nerdy stuff here. The biggest one that's probably gotten the most airplay recently is this BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is a signaling molecule that's involved in nerve cell function, development, and growth, and it promotes nerve cell survival and synaptic integrity. It's crucial for brain plasticity, which is like a buzzword now, like improve your brain plasticity. It's like, okay, like define that for me. And regulation of memory function. So BDNF is heavily involved in all this stuff. Patients with Alzheimer's disease do have low blood and low brain levels of BDNF from early stages of the disease. And BDNF levels are positively correlated with cognitive function. Lo and behold, exercise does induce certain molecules like BDNF, increases levels of those. And this has emerged as a maybe key mediator of the cognitive benefits of exercise, particularly as it pertains to Alzheimer's disease. How exercise stimulates the production of BDNF in the brain is currently unknown. It could be due to myokines. These are hormones released from the contracting muscle during exercise. It could be due to these, specifically we're talking about cathepsin B, irisin. These are myokines that are currently known that have been shown to increase BDNF. But again, full disclosure, and again, I'd like to draw your attention to the differences that we do on this particular podcast. These are rat studies. And so as far as how this correlates to the human experience and actually what you do in practice, unclear. but these are mostly for like bar talk conversation to look smart in front of your friends. There's also some evidence that lactate levels, which is a product of anaerobic metabolism, when you're lifting heavy weights or you're doing higher intensity conditioning efforts, that that actually triggers some BDNF production. But again, these are all mechanisms, right? Austin, if I could tell you, hey, we can increase your BDNF levels by 100%, what do you think? Be like,
neat.
Oh, I guess that's good. Is that good? Like, yeah, unclear. And I can't tell you, right? So there are other mechanisms that we know about with respect to exercise and how it might affect someone's trajectory with Alzheimer's disease or their risk. So exercise in general reduces inflammation. It is pro-inflammatory while you're doing it, but the net effect of exercise is to reduce inflammation. It also, the oxidative stress sort of milieu, if you will. Yes, while you're exercising, oxidative stress goes up, but again, net oxidative stress goes down. There are other biomarkers. Some of these I'd literally never heard of, and I'm like, what in the world is this? Pittsburgh compound B or phosphorylated tau protein? I know what tau protein is, but like, oh, the phosphorylated version? What is that? All this is to say, there are a lot of Petri dish studies on this, animal model studies on this, and I do find that stuff interesting on some level, but when it comes to affecting what I tell people to do or what how you should, I think, interpret this, I think it's relatively useless. Like, I don't necessarily care what happens in a Petri dish, what happens in an animal model, unless it's been replicated in a human study, in which case I didn't need any of that background knowledge to know that. I just need to know what happens in human studies. So all that's well and good. Let's talk about the actual outcomes that we see when people with Alzheimer's disease or those who are at potential risk of Alzheimer's disease, what happens when they exercise, okay? So probably the best study I was able to find is a meta-analysis of 10 studies, 23,000 patients with the follow-up ranging from 4 to 30 years that showed that adherence to just the aerobic component of the physical activity guidelines. And for those who are new to the podcast, that's greater than 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous conditioning activity is associated with a 40% reduction in the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Just hitting the aerobic thing, 2 hours and some change of conditioning per week, a 40% reduction in Alzheimer's disease, that's big. That's big. And you would predict it would be higher if they also did some resistance training or if they did more conditioning. But yeah, 23,000 patients, 10 studies. Like, Austin, how many rat studies would you need to like stack up against that?
Like nearly infinite. And of course, because you're emphasizing the nuance here, a lot of these are not necessarily trials that randomize people to these different exercise interventions over time. And so, you know, when we have these kind of observational data, I would say that, you know, perhaps you could make an argument that these effect estimates are going to be overstated compared to, you know, if you were to randomize people, because people who are able to do that or people who are willing to do that kind of exercise from an observational standpoint are maybe fundamentally different than those who don't. But I think that the signal is still quite strong, quite consistent, pretty compelling, low risk intervention, high potential benefit intervention as it relates to both dementia and other things. And so that remains, like, again, my strongest recommendation for folks here.
Yeah. Built differently, incorrectly, I think. Also seems that there's a long-lasting effect of exercise on people's sort of trajectory here. So there's a recent study, 6 months of resistance training improved cognition and protected folks from the structural and functional degeneration of the hippocampus. They basically used PET scans and functional MRIs to look at like hippocampal volume and function. And this was still present even 12 months after their last training session. Now, I would prefer that people just kept training like indefinitely, right? But it does seem to show that there's some sort of lasting effect of exercise as well. Unfortunately, there's relatively little data on muscle strengthening activity and prospective trials outside of that. We do know that folks who are stronger in general like tend to have a lower risk of Alzheimer's disease later in life. But whether, again, that's sort of just a correlation versus causal, we don't really know because these have not been randomized. So the TLDR on this is that exercise seems to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease both through direct and indirect mechanisms. Indirectly, exercise has been shown to repeatedly positively affect risk factors like high blood pressure, elevated blood cholesterol levels, insulin resistance, body composition, and so on. Exercise also improves function via better strength, coordination, and cardiorespiratory fitness. However, many questions remain regarding the magnitude of effect in those with Alzheimer's disease at various stages. So those are folks with Alzheimer's disease, the preclinical Alzheimer's disease, prodromal Alzheimer's disease, et cetera. And also, like, what's the optimal type of exercise? there's more questions to be answered here, in my opinion. All right, last thing that we'll talk about before we wrap this up is going to be dietary pattern. Austin, when you see somebody with dementia in the hospital, when on their discharge instructions, I assume that you're recommending a very specific diet. Is that that's true?
Once the dementia is already established, dietary recommendations are going to be, you know, challenging, and there might be even more kind of considerations. Like sometimes these patients with dementia are, have various difficulties with chewing and swallowing, and so they might need, you know, particular, you know, modified type diets just to even get any nutrition in safely. But yeah, by that point, you've kind of lost the game, unfortunately. So again, here we're focusing a lot more on what we can do earlier in life and, you know, impact cumulative exposure as best as we can to reduce the risk of developing it. But once it's entrenched, and particularly if it's advanced, then I'm like oftentimes trying to get any nutrition that I can into them so that they don't waste away or suck it down into their lungs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't aspirate. Don't do that. And then make sure you're not wasting away because you're not eating anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, the dietary pattern is obviously important for the affecting the risk factors we've discussed previously, and then likely to some extent the disease process itself. One of the probably, you know, headlines that was blasted across mainstream media is that, you know, a healthy dietary pattern reduces Alzheimer's disease by 55%. And it's like, yeah, there's a meta-analysis that shows that. But then when you go look at the study, which is, I've linked it in the description below, it's Zhu 2015. You look at what are the components of the healthy dietary pattern. They don't define them. They just call it a healthy dietary pattern. And they principally was related to fiber intake, which, okay, like if you were looking for like a single thing to like, you know, evaluate somebody's healthy diet, like fiber intake seems like a proxy for that, but I would want to use more stuff. So in general, I'll kind of summarize up front. In general, healthy dietary patterns are made up primarily of unprocessed and minimally processed foods. Specifically, they tend to contain lots of plant matter, so things like fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts, seeds, and lean proteins. And there have been many specific dietary patterns that have been studied to varying degrees. So like the Mediterranean diet, for example, which is rich in olive oil, fish, whole grains, fruit, vegetables, legumes, nuts, beans, seeds, dairy, poultry, et cetera, and a relatively small amount of processed foods and red meat, there's a pretty consistent reduction in Alzheimer's disease, though the effect of the Mediterranean diet varies based on how bad the starting diet is or the comparator diet. So for example, the biggest reduction for Alzheimer's disease via the Mediterranean dietary pattern is seen in America, where there's about a 40% risk reduction from the standard westernized diet, which we'll get to that shortly. You compare that to a 20-year study in Spain, that only showed a 20% risk reduction, presumably because their comparator dietary pattern was not quite as bad. And then you move to France, and there's no association with eating the Mediterranean diet, perhaps because they're already eating something like that. There's another dietary pattern called the MIND diet, which stands for Mediterranean-Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay. This basically combines elements from both the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, which is an acronym that stands for the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. Just as an aside, we're really bad at acronyms in medicine. Like, why does everything need an acronym? Anyway, so basically combine the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet together and has a specific focus on dietary components with, as they claim, neuroprotective effects. So in this particular diet, they emphasize the consumption of berries, green leafy vegetables, nuts, and high cacao chocolate rather than a high intake of other fruits and vegetables. So I guess they're just getting more, it's like a more specific type of the Mediterranean diet.
Color polyphenols and flavonoids and things like that, which I would say have some evidence for it. It's not like, you know, earth shattering, but almost no intervention in the world of dementia is like completely earth shattering, aside from probably exercise. I'm fine with this diet, as I'm fine with a lot of other, you know, generally healthy dietary patterns. When I'm talking with patients a lot of the time and we're working through, you know, a dietary setup for them, oftentimes I happen to recommend a lot of these things anyway, like berries as a source of, you know, not only fruit, fiber, you know, plenty of flavonoids and polyphenols if you want to get to that kind of molecular level, and green leafy vegetables and nuts for a lot of reasons, both cardiovascular and metabolic and neurologic. And I'm not making these recommendations with like very particular disease end states in mind, but this diet, the MIND diet, which makes sense why it's named that, if that's your primary concern of like, I want to arrange my entire diet around concerns of neurodegeneration, then this is a fine way to go, I would say.
Sure. Yeah, I would agree. There's also been a lot of discussion about the ketogenic diet, This is characterized by high fat and low carbohydrate intake, promoting ketone production for energy. There's a lot of weird claims about the keto diet on the internet, especially with respect to, quote, brain health. And then you ask somebody to define brain health and you're going to get a bunch of weird answers. So you can almost just dismiss that and further question the veracity of their initial statement. That said, yes, there are some promising results on cognitive function using validated tests. However, the ketogenic diet has not really been compared to other healthy dietary patterns like the Mediterranean diet or the MIND diet in a controlled manner for sufficiently long periods of time. What you would want to know, and this could just be a, you know, prospective study where you'd have some people on a Mediterranean diet who prefer that dietary pattern. You'd have some people on the MIND diet who prefer that dietary pattern, some people on a ketogenic diet who prefer that dietary pattern, and other folks who didn't change their diet at all, and track them for a, you know, relatively long period of time and see if there's any difference. Until that data set comes along, you know, and it's sufficiently powered and well-controlled, I don't know that I can say that the MIND diet's better than the Mediterranean diet, Mediterranean diet's better than the MIND diet, the ketogenic diet's better than both. It's just another diet for people with different preferences. That's kind of how I, where I shake out on that. It's the same thing with the Mediterranean ketogenic diet, which is MMKD, another acronym for God knows what reason. There's vegetarian diets, vegan diets, obviously. And so all of these things can work through maybe different mechanisms that you would, you know, predict, but how it shakes out outcome-wise is kind of still unknown, right? Virtually all of these, especially if they help control for body composition, body weight, and they increase the consumption of minimally processed and unprocessed foods, reduce the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages and other processed foods with added sugar, all of them are going to work to some degree. Whether or not there's a difference in magnitude depends on, you know, how they're executed, how they're adhered to, and probably the individual and how they respond to a given diet. And finally, the comparator diet. What sort of diet were they eating before? So maybe the worst diet, which happens to maybe also be one of the most common diets, is the Western diet, which most people in America tend to eat. This is, 70% of the calories in the Western diet are from ultra-processed foods. And so the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages like soda and other ultra-processed foods like cookies, sweetened cereals, candies, frozen pizza, and similar have increased to account for over 50% of energy intake in most folks' diet in the United States. Overall, the Western diet's low in fruit, low in vegetables, low in whole grains, low in fiber, beans, etc., and high in ultra-processed foods. And no surprise, that tends to have a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease compared to pretty much any other healthy dietary pattern. So overall, to me, there's strong evidence that adherence to any number of healthy dietary patterns, such as the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, the Mediterranean DASH diet, the modified Mediterranean ketogenic diet, whatever, all that stuff seems to work, but it's likely just personal preference because we just don't know. All these diets also seem to have a benefit based on common factors, such as an increased intake of polyunsaturated fats, particularly from fish, high fiber intake, polyphenols and flavonoids, and other neuroprotective nutrients and compounds. So things like from polyphenols, flavonoids, et cetera, from berries, cacao, green leafy vegetables, nuts, and olive oil. These are all combined within the foods. We're not asking you to supplement these things. And to that point, there's a number of studies in petri dishes, rats, some even in humans, that hyper-focus on specific nutrients, folate, omega-3 fatty acids, various vitamins or vitamines, as we should say, and other various compounds in food. But we shouldn't separate the nutrients from the foods they come in and to a greater extent, the dietary pattern at large. I think the dietary pattern is the most predictive of health outcomes. Then it's going to be the foods that are actually being consumed. And then last is going to be like the micronutrient sort of status. So did you see that reel going around on social media? It's like calories determine your body weight. Macronutrients determine your body composition. Micronutrients determine how you feel. And I'm like, food matrix affect anyone? Like what the... You know, just
another one of those things. Sounds good if you don't think about it.
Sounds great if you don't think about it. That's right. All right. Let's wrap this thing up, Austin, unless you had more to add on the nutrition.
No, I think that tidies it up. Looking that myopically at individual nutrients, in my opinion, is not wise. But and for the same reason, I don't tend to advise people on, you know, here's the specific diet that you should do just to decrease your risk of dementia. It's like the same way looking at just one nutrient that you need. I'm only looking at diet through the lens of like one organ, like just for your brain. It's like, well, as it turns out, what tends to be particularly healthy for your brain tends to be healthy for a lot of things. Now, of course, there may be, you know, certain aspects that might be better or worse for one particular organ or another, but there's a lot of convergence between all these different diets. And those are some of the features that you outlined, be it related to polyunsaturated fats and fiber and polyphenols and flavonoids and all those kind of things that people just don't need to worry about at that like tiny molecular level,
no.
But rather those foods that we outlined, if you would prefer to incorporate them in your diet more regularly, I think that's a great thing, particularly if they, you know, edge out other less healthful things and in terms of replacement.
Agreed. All right, let's wrap this up. So in summary, Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia affecting millions of people worldwide. The lifetime risk of Alzheimer's disease is somewhere around 10 to 12% in most developed countries. Now, advanced age and genetics are two major risk factors driving Alzheimer's disease that are, at the time of this recording, non-modifiable. However, there are a number of other risk factors we can and do, we can do something about with lifestyle and medical interventions, especially if we start early in life. Now, the idea of cumulative risk exposure should not be taken lightly when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, as the first clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease typically appear about 20 years after initial structural changes can be detected in the brain. Most people would benefit from starting now to optimize risk factors such as blood pressure, blood cholesterol, blood sugar levels, body composition, physical activity, and dietary pattern. Unfortunately, many lifestyle changes are not taken up early enough, if at all. This is especially true with respect to exercise and healthy diet, which, broadly speaking, are underprescribed, underdosed, and undersupported. Now, lifelong exercise to meet or, more preferably, exceed the current guidelines should be recognized as vital within the medical community. With respect to Alzheimer's disease, the existing evidence suggests exercise can potentially reduce risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, as well as reduce associated decline if it is already present. It's not yet known what the optimal type of exercise is, though there does seem to be a dose-dependent relationship between exercise and reduced Alzheimer's disease risk. The more people exercise and the longer they do it, the better. We recommend a combination of both lifting weights and conditioning to improve all aspects of physical fitness. Finally, the development of many risk factors leading to Alzheimer's disease takes years to manifest, and similarly, reducing the risk via dietary change takes sustained adherence to a healthy dietary pattern. There are many types of diets that can work in this regard. Ultimately, personal preference likely supersede any specific dietary pattern that we can recommend. Instead, efforts should be focused on increasing the intake of lean protein, fruits, vegetables, and plants in general, while also reducing processed foods with added sugar, added sodium, and/or added fats, especially sugar-sweetened beverages. Kind of sounds like what we'd recommend for basically any acquired disease. Thoughts?
Most of them, yeah. The only thing I would add, I mean, a lot of this was great for either, you know, reducing the risk of developing it or reducing the rate of decline if it's present. If you have any concerns about, say, yourself or a family member or something like that experiencing one of these things, advise seeing a physician for evaluation, particularly looking at potentially reversible, treatable causes to see if it's something else could be going on, and not pursuing, direct to consumer testing on things. You would not want to go about that, maybe find something or not find something that was present, that was treatable, and that could potentially have fixed the issue. There are certainly situations where something that looks an awful lot like dementia just ends up needing a pretty simple treatment and it gets better. Unfortunately, that's not all the time or maybe even most of the time, mm-hmm. but it is possible. And so those are the cases we really try to seek out because we can do a ton for it. And then the rest, we're aiming hopefully to prevent from happening at all through all of these kind of things. And if they're present, then still doing all of these things to, you know, slow down the decline as much as possible.
Yeah, I like it. All right. That is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for giving us his time as we talked about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.